This is Audible.
Chile Redemption by Stephen Baxter. Read by Dudley Hinton. Part 1. There have always been engineers in my family. George Poole, AD 2005. Chapter 1. He was the last human. He was beyond time and space. The great quantum functions which encompassed the universe slid past him like a vast, turbulent river, and his eyes were filled with the grey light against which all phenomena are shadows. Time wore away unmarked. And then, millions of years after the Quack's invasion, millions of years after his own descent into the wormholes and deep time, there was a box, drifting in space, cubical, clear-walled. From around an impossible corner, a human walked into the box. He wore a battered skin suit of an old-fashioned design. He stared out, astonished, at stars bright, teeming, young, detonating. Michael Poole's extended awareness stirred. Something had changed. History had resumed. Chapter 2. Ship elapsed time since launch. 6 years, 219 days. Earth date, AD 4106. Jophiel Poole was born in a moment of doubt, although he wasn't even called Jophiel at that point. A second after his creation, Poole knew where he was, and he knew, to a reasonable degree of accuracy on a number of timescales, when he was. His problem was that, just for a heartbeat, he wasn't sure who he was, real or otherwise. At least he could determine that. Poole looked at his own right hand, turned it over, flexed his fingers, and then waved it towards a chair standing beside him. The hand passed through the substance of the chair, the fingers breaking up briefly into strings of blocky pixels, before congealing with a sharp ache. Consistency protocols, designed in part to protect the rights of artificial people themselves, demanded that virtuals lived in the human world as far as possible. If you were in a vacuum, you wore a pressure suit. Of course, it was possible to cheat, such as by passing a hand through a solid object, but if you did so, it hurt. Anyhow, I'm the virtual, he said. A disposable copy of the template of Michael Poole, created for a one-off purpose, then to be scienced back and disposed of. Lucked out. Later, he would wonder if he had had some premonition at this moment of his own complicated fate to come, including meeting yet another copy of himself before the day was out. For now, all he felt was a vague confusion. He looked around. He was standing in a small executive suite at the summit of a gut-ship life dome, a big hemisphere. He was a full radius, 400 metres above the floor deck. Looking down, he saw his, or rather Michael Poole's, ship in complex cross-section. The crew in their bright red or blue coveralls, blue for virtuals like himself, pursuing their work, their play, their lives. This was a starship, an integrated machine of technology and humanity. Above his head, outside the dome, was a tetrahedral skeleton, electric blue, glowing faintly in the vacuum of space. This was the entrance to a wormhole network that connected this craft, the Cauchy, to the other two ships of this small fleet. The interface was pretty much all that was visible outside the dome. The sky was darkened, the stars obscured, by the gutship's sheer velocity, by a distortion of space and time that swept up the starlight, relativity in action. The effects of long-duration spaceflight were not intuitive. Accelerating at a standard gravity, after about a year you approached light speed. If you kept thrusting after that, you just pushed ever harder against that unbreakable barrier, your energy pouring into increased mass energy rather than extra velocity, the dilation effect making time and space bend like molten glass. More than 6 years after leaving the solar system, after 6 years of the mighty gut drive thrusting at a steady gravity, the Cauchy was moving so close to light speed that, as seen from Earth, the vessel's space-time frame was massively distorted. For every day that passed for Poole, more than a year passed on cold Earth. To put it another way, the 6 years experienced by Poole so far was equivalent to 4 centuries back on Earth. With time, that disparity would get wider. And too, so hard was the Cauchy pushing against light speed that the star fields through which it fled could not be seen true. Poole was hurtling into the starlight, as if he was running into rain, the drops sweeping into his face. So now all Poole saw of the starlight was a misty grey patch directly ahead of the ship, beyond the wormhole interface. Otherwise, darkness. It was going to be this way for another 12 years or more of ship's time, after which the ship would slow at last, and the sky of the galaxy's core would unfold all around them. But at least the Cauchy was not alone. Poole saw 2 matchsticks in the dark, companionship's naked eye visible, keeping pace. The gear, the island. Like the Cauchy, each was a glowing dome topping a gaunt spine some 3 kilometers long, leading to a block of Oort cloud ice and the gleaming spark of a gut-drive thruster, bright in the relativistic dark. And each was topped by its own neat electric blue tetrahedron. Physically, these triplets kept a safe distance from each other. Transfer of crew and supplies between the ships was by wormhole only. Slim, shining with gut energy, the craft looked like weapons, Poole thought. Spears tipped by blades of exotic matter. Well, they were weapons. Humans weren't going to the center of the galaxy to explore. Outside the life dome, nothing but those other ships. Inside, people. 50 of them in the Cauchy, plus more in her companions. A hive of people, all busily moving around according to their duties or their leisure schedule, 2/3 of the crew presumably, while the other third, the off-duty watch, slept in darkened quarters. All of this was embraced in a barely visible tracery of the technology that kept them all alive in this void, embedded in the walls and floors, the brightly lit hydroponic banks, the ranks of sleeper pods, the massive systems that circulated and renewed their air and water. Michael Poole, the original, this virtual's copy's template, was more than 50 years old now, subjective. He had been 44 when the flotilla had left cold Earth. Though AS treatments had preserved him at a physical age of around 25, there were times when he felt the weight of all those years, that half-century. And Poole, or his template, was an engineer, and a major part of him always longed to be far away from all this people stuff. Ideally to be 3 kilometers away, at the other end of the ship's spine, buried in the heart of an engine he had done so much to develop and refine. A tangle of pipes and ducts and cables and monitor screens all surrounding the glistening gut-drive pod itself. Like working within the organs of some tremendous beast. Still, as he gazed down from this virtual Olympus, as he watched the crew who had joined him on his quest into the dark, he felt an unreasonable stab of affection. Not that he could ever voice such sentiments out loud. And when he glanced across this apex suite, he looked back at himself, No, he saw Michael Poole, the true Poole, sitting at a desk, evidently preparing for the upcoming special crew review. He was sweeping through virtual reports, pages of data, images of talking heads, wearing a coverall of brilliant red. He had a tattoo on his forehead, a crude green tetrahedron. In another universe, another timeline, that had been known as the sigil of free humanity. Virtual Poole prepared to go over to begin the work he had been created for. "Hey." A voice that was familiar, and yet not. Poole hesitated, turned, to find himself looking into a mirror. It was, unmistakably, Michael Poole. Another copy? Himself, and yet not quite. The new copy wore a faded grey coverall, not a standard issue aboard the Couchy. Pockets big enough for tools. And he had a sense of age about him, too. Grey in the hair, a certain softness in the brown eyes that looked back. He looked more like 60 than 50, Poole thought, and he seemed fragile, as if he were recovering from some injury. The other grinned. "Take your time. Time's the one thing I'm not short of." Oddly, his lip movements did not quite sync with his speech. "Who are you? Another virtual? I don't remember spinning you off." "Not that. Although, maybe I have something of that quality. More information than flesh." Some kind of processing glitch, then. A ghost copy." The other grimaced. "A ghost, maybe. I do seem to find it easier to reach you than him." He gestured at Poole at his desk. "I don't know why. Glad you came along, but then there's a lot I don't understand, as ever." That smile again. "Reality leaks, is all I know. As if the universe itself has doubts sometimes. We'll work it out together, I guess. Leith, we've got to work together to get through this. Remember that." "Get through what? Who are you talking to?" He turned. Nicola Emery was walking over to him. She was expected. He'd called her up here to discuss some points, or rather Poole, his template, had called her before he was spun off. He turned back. The other Poole had gone. Nicola was studying him, curious, amused. "Get through what, you said?" Poole didn't know how to reply, even to her, even though there was nobody on board closer to Poole than Nicola, and that had been true long before the flotilla had left Cold Earth. She had been with Michael Poole when a Chile warship had burst out of a Poole Industries prototype fast transit system wormhole, intent, it soon emerged, on destroying mankind. And she had stuck by him through what followed, through the ravaging of the solar system, all the way to the scattering of mankind. The crew called her Keeper of the Amulet. Even Max Ward, Poole's senior military advisor, as manipulative and ambitious as he was competent, wasn't going to prise apart that relationship any time soon. Not that she wasn't difficult. Nicola was in her mid-50s now, and she wore the wrinkles around her eyes and mouth, the greying of her short-cropped hair like badges of honour. Famously and very unusually, she had always refused any AS treatment. And although her own coverall, rather ostentatiously covered with training mission patches and weapon loops, was bright red, she scarcely needed it. Nicola was also notorious for refusing to throw off virtual projections of herself. If Nicola approached you, You could be sure it was the authentic article. Now she looked at Poole with that amused concern.
Baby's only a minute old and he doesn't look happy.
I'm fine.
Well, that sounds like a Poole. Pure denial.
You know, I've seen you do this over and over. Throwing off virtual copies like shedding skins. Such as when you, or a copy of you, rode with me and my monopole bandits against the Chile at the stop line before Earth. And then you soak it all back in again with whatever memories the latest puppet gathered during its short, pathetic bit of independent life.
Not sure if you're helping here, Nicola.
You never gave a thought to what you were doing to yourself. Creating a separate, sentient, short-lived copy that was you until the moment of projection, and then taking it back into your own head. I always wondered if that chain of mini-deaths was some kind of self-punishment for the calamity you brought down on the solar system. The Chile came for you, in a sense, after all. You, though... She stared into his unreal eyes. You're different, somehow.
Just differently irritated by you.
Tell me how you feel.
Like I have a job to do.
What job?
Well,
his own hesitation surprised him.
Leith, you don't know, do you?
Or aren't sure, at least. That's new.
Again, he looked at his own hands.
I do remember casting off all those previous copies. Of course I do. I did it. Every time before I found myself in a red uniform, looking out at a copy in blue.
Ah. The problem is...
She jabbed a finger at his chest, pulling back before touching him and violating various consistency protocols.
This time you woke up to find the copy is you.
She grinned maliciously.
Lucked out indeed.
And you don't like it, do you? Now you know why I never create these avatars myself, for fear of waking up like you, on the wrong side of the mirror. Now his original, evidently distracted by the conversation, walked over from his desk.
Why all the chatter?
He looked at his copy.
Have you some problem?
Look, if there's been some defect in the copying, I can wipe you and...
No.
He found himself biting back the word, please. Nicola glowered at template Poole.
You're all heart, aren't you?
You've got no idea what this creature is feeling, have you?
The virtual Poole winced.
Creature. Nicola grinned, not without malice.
I am on your side.
Thanks. Template Poole looked uncertain.
I never had any trouble with virtual copies before.
You define the mission, you create the copy, off it goes.
Well, something was different this time. What is he for?
He, not it. Template Poole frowned. Maybe he had noticed that too.
To fix the problems on gear, of course.
Now virtual, Poole remembered. One of the sister ship's gear was a hull crammed with artificial sentience hardware and software and crewed solely by virtuals, spun off from hibernating originals. Gear was intended to be the brain of the fleet. With the green glowing island as its heart and the weapons-laden Couchy as its fist. You were to go over and sort out the power drain problems. The fouled-up science reports. You know the protocol. Only virtual visits to the gear for the sake of physical stability. All those delicate processing suites.
That's it, Poole said, remembering.
I wasn't focusing. I mean, you weren't focusing. You were thinking about the second generation issue. This is a warship, not a creche. That was the line you had added to your notes for your speech just when... Poole held up a hand.
Okay. My fault.
I threw off a flawed copy while distracted, but the process is usually more robust than that.
Distracted.
That was the problem, virtual Poole saw. This mission was Michael Poole's. The goal was to pursue the Chile and, if possible, to destroy it, as vengeance for what it had wrought on the solar system. It was assumed that the solitary ship had carried one individual, but nobody knew if the Chile could be distinguished from its technology, or if the ship had carried some kind of collective. In the 37th century, nothing had been known of the Chile save its, their, name. From the beginning, Poole's crew had shared in that goal, the determination to pursue the Chile. That was why they had volunteered to follow him. But Poole was an engineer, not a military officer, not a captain. He could command, but it was always a cognitive strain, even worse when Poole was called on to inspire. He had been overloaded, distracted, and as a result, this. "So, what now?" Nicola pressed. "Are you going to collapse this guy and throw off another copy?" Virtual Poole held his breath. He had no power here, he realized. His existence was in the hands of this other, a copy of himself divergent by only a few minutes. But Template Poole, too, seemed pricked by doubt. "I guess not. You know the mission well enough. Come to the briefing to pick up anything new." Poole let out that breath cautiously, not wishing to give away his relief. But his template noticed, even so, "You aren't supposed to feel like this, you know. Like I said, the other copies never gave any trouble." "How do you know?" Nicholas snapped at him. "You weren't inside their heads looking out. Did you ever ask? Maybe they all felt like this copy." "Don't call me a copy." Template Poole stared at him. "So, what do you want to be called?" Poole hesitated. Nicola grinned. "Jophiel. I hereby dub you Jophiel." The template frowned. "What in Leith is that?" "An angel's name. You know I like my mythology. And the Pooles have got a habit of naming their sons after angels, haven't they, Michael? Such as Gabriel, who set up the Antarctic freeze-out in the 27th century. Consider it my gift to you. I, your keeper of the amulet." She looked at the two of them as they faced each other uncertainly. "Well, this has been fun. Aren't we late for the crew briefing?" Poole, Jophiel, nodded. "I guess I can just fly down. Wings are optional for us virtual angels." "Don't screw around," Michael Poole snarled. "Stick to the consistency protocols. And you keep the color code coveralls, whatever you call yourself." Nicola snapped off a mocking, elaborate monopole bandit salute. "Yes, sir." Poole stormed off. Jophiel followed with Nicola. He felt disoriented, bewildered. He was, after all, only minutes old. And he thought back to his encounter with that other Poole, the mysterious older Poole in the worn coveralls. The nature of his own miraculous birth, his brush with imminent death, weren't even the strangest things he'd experienced in those minutes. Reality leaks. Nicola was watching him. "You look odd. Are you still you? Do you remember it all?"
"I think so."
"Remember what, exactly?"
"Where it all began. The Poole compound in Antarctica, the family gathering, and the amulet. You went to the window about as far as you could get from the family."
Beyond the window, he could see a handful of bright, drifting stars, the latest ships of the scattering still visible across distances comparable to the width of the inner solar system. He always carried the amulet these days, the green tetrahedron delivered from another universe by a dead alien. He kept it in a fold of soft cloth tucked into his belt. On impulse, he got it out now and unfolded the cloth and looked at the amulet sitting there, green on black. He grasped the amulet in his bare fist. Its vertices were sharp, digging into his flesh, drawing blood. Nicola joined him.
Careful with that.
Got it back from my mother, taking it with me.
She mentioned some kind of image retrieved from the interior.
We only just got it out. Very advanced data compression, took years to extract it.
You didn't tell me.
He shrugged. I didn't want to have to discuss it in front of them, the family. Let Muriel tell them.
Show me.
He glanced at her, then waved a hand in the air.
A virtual image coalesced.
A jewel-like object, like a black ball wrapped in an asymmetrical gold blanket, lay on a carpet of stars. And some distance away, a fine blue band surrounded it. Poole said,
"Tell me what you see." "That looks like gravitational lensing. The gold, the way it's distorted, light paths distorted by an extreme gravity field, a black hole. Like the one at the centre of the galaxy."
"Tell me what you see."
"It looks like a black hole with a ring around it. What is it?"
"A black hole with a ring around it." She stared and grinned.
"And that's where we're going."
He glared out once more at Sagittarius. Overlaid on the constellation stars, he saw a reflection of his own face, dimly outlined. The dark complexion, dark hair, the face of a pool. And that tetrahedral scar on his forehead was livid. He whispered,
"Are you out there somewhere? Can you hear me? My name is Michael Poole. Chile, I'm coming to get you."
Nicola grinned.
"You do remember? Leith, yes. A ring, a wheel around a supermassive black hole. And presumably the Chile is on its way to the galaxy core to build the thing."
He eyed her. "That's not all, by the way. We kept examining the amulet that Michael Poole did, and he found glimpses of other stuff."
"Such as?"
"Such as another structure. A monster even compared to the galaxy center wheel, off in extragalactic space. We have no idea what that's for either." She looked at him carefully.
"You never told me about that before."
"Michael didn't."
"Yes."
He grinned. "But evidently I'm not Michael, am I?" He looked over. Michael had already left the suite. "Come on. We're going to be late."
Chapter 3. "You know why we're here," Max Ward said. He stalked the floor of the amphitheatre, walking a few paces to and fro, dominating. Ward was a squat, muscular man, head-shaved, AS preserved at about 30. In reality, he was around the same age as Poole. Every eye was on him. The amphitheatre, a small public space, was just a terraced pit in the middle of the floor of the life dome, on the lowest habitable level, above hidden layers of life support infrastructure. Most of the Couchy's 50 crew were here in person. Even, presumably, some of the one-third theoretically on sleep rota, standing or sitting in an informal sprawl. Jophiel saw there were a few virtual presences, like himself, decked out in electric blue amid the red uniforms. Some were even projected from the other ships of the flotilla. For now, Jophiel observed, Michael stood back from the centre as Ward took the stage. Ward grinned, wolfish. Well, I'm guessing you know why we're here. What with your being the crew of a starship and all? He started to get the answers he was looking for. Better this than another of your drills, Max. Don't ask me, I'm still asleep. Leith, you guys are hilarious. No more quizzes. I'll show you where we are and why we're here. Ward waved his arm, and a virtual image of the galaxy sparkled into existence above his head, the dazzling core wrapped around by spiralling lanes of stars and dust. Jophiel saw this from one side, and could see the startling fineness of that disk, hundreds of billions of stars gathered into a plane as thin as paper, relative to the scale of the galaxy as a whole. Asher Fennell kindly prepared this stuff for me, the latest imagery. Here's where we started from. The location of Sol blinked. Towards the periphery of the disk, an electric blue firefly. Here's where we're going. A spark at the very heart of the galaxy, marking the position of the supermassive black hole there, lurking in its own deep gravitational pit. 25,000 light-years from the sun. You want the good news? This is the 219th day of the 7th year of our mission, and we'll get to the core before the 20-year mark. By, Jophiel knew, steadily accelerating at one gravity to a halfway turnaround point, and then steadily decelerating, allowing the relativistic distortion to unwind. The outside universe would see the fleet, mostly cruising at near lightweight speed, take 25,000 years to cross the 25,000 light-years to the core, as experienced by the crew less than 20 years would pass, as Ward had said. But here's the bad news, Ward said now. A bright red line inched out of the Sol marker, creeping towards the core. It made it only a 50th of the way or so before limping to a stop. This is how far we've got physically, so far. 440 light-years. But even so, to come this far... Anyone know the significance? Somebody shouted, "We already came further than anybody came before." Ward nodded grudgingly. That's about right. The furthest we know any ship from Earth ever got out to the stars, I mean still in one piece, was one of the outriggers. Uncrewed probes launched more than 1,700 years ago by Grey Poole, one of our leader's ancestors. And he nodded at Poole. As it happened, several of the probes came this way, this being the direction of the center of the galaxy and all, and one reached a triple star system called Sagittarii, and called back home. 440 years to get there, 440 more years for its report to crawl back to Earth. Now, we don't know how far out some of these other probes might have got without reporting first, but for sure, we've gone beyond the known. He raised a fist. Into the unknown. He got scattered responses, a tentative whoop. Ward pumped that fist. Come on! Here we are! That's what we're celebrating today, we Leith-spawned rabble. Here we are! And we won't turn back until the job is done. Maxwell Ward had proved himself long before the launch of the Cauchy. He had been a dark hero of the weeks-long Cold War that had raged over a freezing Earth after the planet had been hurled far from its sun. As the survivors fought over the last of the warmth, Ward had actually led an army of a coalition of European nations in an invasion of Iceland, rich in precious geothermal energy. But Jophiel saw him differently now. In every previous crew review, he, not yet separated from the template that was Michael Poole, had stood up there, quietly relieved to let Ward do all the work. But now, from the outside, he saw just how dominant Ward actually was, How passive, barely visible, was Poole? This was Poole's mission, his design. It was Poole who, in a different future, would have been remembered by the Exultants, a generation who would one day have driven the Chile out of the galaxy altogether, and would have erected a statue to Poole himself, 2 kilometers high, standing proud in the core. This strange destiny had been hinted at by scattered records in the millennia-old Poole family archive, as well as even more exotic sources. Reality leaks, Jophiel thought. Well, that was all gone now. The Chile had come back through time, using the Poole family's own trial wormholes, and had attacked the solar system, evidently determined to cut off that future before it had begun. History had changed, humanity's destiny stolen. But humanity itself had survived, and so had Michael Poole. Now, statue or not, he was on his way to the heart of the galaxy. His goal was vengeance. Yes, the mission was all about Poole. Yet it was Ward who everybody was watching. Jophiel felt diminished, embarrassed even. Ward kept it up until he had them all standing, whooping, punching the air as he did. "Here we are! Here we are!" Nicola was beside Jophiel. Quite a showman. "Michael should watch his back," Jophiel murmured. "Make sure you remember that when you're him again." "Here we are!" Eventually Ward ceded the floor to Poole, who began to chair the briefing in a more formal style. The first report was by Bob Thomas. 30 years old, Bob's main function was interstellar navigation. As the couch he pushed against the light barrier, and as the ships probed regions of space never before explored by human craft, Bob was patiently developing flexible, innovative techniques and skills to enable the flotilla to find its way through the uncharted dark, such as using pulsars, spinning, flashing neutron stars as navigation beacons. Some of these bitter little objects rotated hundreds of times every second, and these millisecond pulsars, scattered in 3 dimensions around the sky, could be used as remarkably precise natural lighthouses. The accuracy of the method had been brought down to mere kilometers in terms of the ship's position as it crossed a galaxy 100,000 light-years wide. The Doppler shift of their timings could even give information on the ship's true velocity. All this was being developed in flight by Bob and his team. As Jophiel remembered well, Bob had been one of the 3 children whom Michael Poole had rescued in person from a collapsed building during the Chile's assault on Mars. 3 siblings, who even then had called themselves the Last Martians. All 3 had come with their saviour on his mission to the centre of the galaxy. Many of the crew had known Poole personally before the launch, one way or another. That was why they were here. Now Bob Thomas reported, clearly and competently, on the ship's position in space and time. And he spoke about a side project, the latest observations of the great fleet of which, in a sense, the Cauchy flotilla was an outlier, a fleet they had called the Scattering. To save the Earth from the Chile, Michael Poole had nearly killed it. As the Chile had closed in, he had hurled the Earth through a wormhole to the Oort cloud, the chill outer depths of the solar system. But even amid the calamity of the subsequent freezing, as Earth became cold Earth, there was a keen awareness that this was only a stay of execution, for the Chile would surely follow some day. And so it was necessary to evacuate Earth, most of whose 1 billion inhabitants had survived the displacement, as the Great Shifting had become known. It was Michael Poole's father, Harry, who, as de facto governor of mankind, had set up the Scattering Program.
10,000 gutships were built, 100 a year fired off. Scatterships, they were called, sent in every direction out into the dark, either singly or in fleets. Poole and his flotilla had left long before the century-long programme of launches was finished. The ships had adopted a variety of designs and survival strategies. Most bore hundreds of thousands of passengers, inert in sleep pods, tended by rotating teams of awake medical specialists and technicians. Green ships, like the flotilla's own island, carried eco-habs, as they were called, samples of life on Earth, from the forests, the grasslands, the oceans, and even from off-Earth environments such as Mars. Others were seed ships, carrying embryos or genetic libraries, with the capability of printing out human colonists at an eventual destination. Some ships were essentially virtual environments, like the flotilla's gear, data-rich and crowded with unreal people. And the ships had headed for a variety of targets. Systems like sun-like stars and Earth-like planets, yes, but also exotic targets like the worlds of long-lived red dwarf stars. Even stellar nurseries like the Pleiades cluster, with 1,000 young stars. 10,000 young worlds, perhaps, to be moulded by humanity. These ships were easily visible, even across interstellar distances, if you knew where to look. From Earth, gut ships travelling between the planets of the solar system could have been seen by a naked human eye, like drifting stars. Now Bob spoke of observations of surviving craft and projections to show that most of the fleet still survived, or at least when the crawling photons that carried evidence of the ship's existence had set off on their long journeys towards the receptors in the Cauchy. But, as usual, Bob had grimmer news of ships that had gone dark. Technical failures were the likely cause, but some kind of conflict among the crew wasn't impossible. Jophiel remembered Harry's bleak observation that some of the ships had turned into prison hulks even before they were out of sight of cold Earth. As Bob wrapped up, Max Ward said, "Every ship lost is another grievance we've got against the Chile. Who's up next?" More routine reports followed. Nicola Emery stepped up to give a summary of technical issues concerning the Cauchy itself. Nicola was, by training and experience, a pilot, with not much piloting to do in these long stretches between the stars. She had joined the maintenance teams as a way to educate herself on the ship's systems. Now she gave a competent but jokey summary of the endless work of keeping this huge machine functioning, alone in the dark, with an exotic engine continually firing at one end and a precious, fragile life dome at the other. She talked about the smell of oil and welding and the glare of blowtorches and bulky matter printers and bots of all sizes swarming everywhere, endlessly patching. Ward watched this performance in silence, his face blank. From his point of view, Jophiel thought now, Nicola was clearly an ally of Poole, and therefore an obstacle. So the more she was charismatic and the centre of attention, the less Max liked it. After Nicola, the reports continued. An update on the ship's medical systems and the crew's sickness list was given by Harris Kemp. Aged about 50, Harris had been one of two junior personnel who, at a base called Lorinda in the orbit of Mercury, had once helped Nicola and Michael Poole prepare for a perilous descent into the body of the sun in search of the Chile. Kemp's partner then, a woman about the same age called Asha Fennell, had since specialised in exobiology and astrophysics. When her turn came, she called up more galaxy images of the kind she'd supplied to Ward, and spoke of her search for evidence of life and mind in the galaxy,
a search being made from the first human ship ever to come so far out. And a search, too, for traces of the Chile and its works, so far fruitless. Next, reports were given by visitors from the crews of the other two ships. An older man, dressed rather ostentatiously in a dirt-smeared red coverall, had come over from the Green Ship Island, whose life dome contained a scrap of green parkland that might once have graced any city of Earth's temperate zones. His report was heavy with bioproductivity indices and climate control variables. And then a virtual projection of a young man called Vinebaum Grant gave a report from Gia, carrier of artificial sentience. Poole had known Vinebaum, or anyhow his flesh-and-blood original, and his sister Flammarion. He was a stepson of a colleague called Jack Grant, who himself had left Cold Earth on a scattership laden with scraps of Mars life. Jophiel understood that Vinebaum and his sister, both in their late 20s now, had contributed greatly to Gia's pool of virtual crew. Even, Jophiel had heard, to the extent of spinning off multiple copies of themselves. But Vinebaum was vague in the details about the problems, the anomalous power usage and falling off of useful output from Gia that had so alarmed Poole and his senior colleagues. As Vinebaum spoke, Jophiel was aware of his original glaring at him. Jophiel felt a peculiar resentment. "I'm listening. This is my mission, to go deal with Gia. I know. I'm capable of dealing with it as much as you are. As soon as this is done, Leith. Have all our virtual partials been so resentful? I never knew." Then, once the standard reports had been delivered, Alice Thomas, sister of Bob, got to her feet. Like most of her crewmates, Alice wore a green tetrahedron on her forehead, the sigil of free humanity, another leak from a different history. And she prepared to speak on behalf of the crew's second generation campaign. Max Ward was glowering even before she opened her mouth. Jophiel suppressed a sigh and avoided Poole's gaze. The meeting had already seemed very long to Jophiel, in his new role as an outside observer. Maybe the sheer adrenaline rush of being at the centre of events had previously helped him endure the time. But he knew, too, that the somewhat ragged informality of the way the ship was run was a deliberate design, in part his own, in fact. After all, on this ship alone, they were 50 people who would be trapped in a small box for nearly 20 years, even before they got to their destination. Michael Poole was formerly the ship's captain, and such authority as existed derived from him, with Max Ward as second in command. There were formal roles such as navigator, chief engineer, helm, head of comms. Experienced officers had quickly organized the crew into three watches, rotated through each ship's day, with commanding officers assigned. But aside from that, the hierarchy was loose. As the years passed, the crew were rotated to be trained in different roles, a way to keep their interest up, as well as to provide the mission with resilience in case of loss. A kind of bottom-up network of advisory committees had developed to cover different issues, with elaborate rules concerning debate and decision-making, and at reviews like this, all were invited to contribute to the discussion. Poole, a little bewildered, had accepted all this, under advice from Nicola, among others, and slowly he had started to see the point. If nothing else, it was something to do. Alice Thomas had once given him an impassioned talk about the elaborate marriage rules some native Australians had developed in the bush. "If the world is empty, you fill your head with culture, with other people." And Jophiel, or his template, had seen for himself that the crew were evolving their own culture with time. Hence, the second generation movement, who argued that a rule forbidding conception and birth aboard the three gutships should be abandoned. When Alice paused in her summary argument, Poole gave the blunt rebuttal he had drafted earlier. "This is a warship, not a creche." But in response, Alice was passionate and logical.
"Crews of warships or not, we have to stay human. They say that in the lost future the Exultans beat the Chili precisely by staying human. That's the way they won their war, and it's how we'll win ours. And what's more human than to have a child?"
She glared at Michael Poole, as if challenging him over his own legend. Max Ward just glowered throughout, Jophiel observed, like a thundercloud about to burst. Poole let the discussion continue until it ran out of steam without resolution. The final item on the agenda, every time the crew met, was always the same. This had been Nicola's idea, Poole reluctantly accepting her proposal, calling it a testimony. This session it was the turn of Ben Goober, not much more than a kid, a junior officer involved in astronomy and interstellar navigation. Now in a scuffed red jumpsuit, he took the stage, glanced around, dropped his eyes. "So," he said. Then he straightened up. "So," he said again, louder. "Sorry, I know I mumble." Sympathetic laughter.
"Go for it, Ben!"
Look, when the displacement happened, when Earth became cold Earth, I was only 3. I remember a lot of it, I think. But some of that might be stories my family told me after, when I was still a kid. My father was American, my mother Japanese. I had a kid sister, a year younger than me. We were out in the sunlight. We lived in Kansas when the Chile attack came. It was the fall, I remember that. We had these huge piles of leaves that I used to love to jump around in, and my sister toddled after me. That was what we were doing that day when the Chile came to Earth, jumping on the leaves. I remember lights in the sky and a shaking. I thought it must be an earthquake. I wouldn't have had the words, but I'd seen virtuals. And my mother had lived through quakes in Japan. I ended up on the floor and my sister fell back in the leaves. My parents came running from the house, I remember that. My mother grabbed me and my dad dived into the leaves to grab my sister. Another big shake. And the lights went out. That's what I thought, like a power failure. But we were outside. The sun had gone, of course. My mother was screaming. Then there was a really big jolt. A tree, a big old oak in front of the house, came down on the leaf pile. He hesitated. The silence, Jophiel thought, was sympathetic. They were all, save the very youngest, survivors of this terrible trauma. They all had stories to tell, however imperfectly. And in this forum, one by one, they got those stories told. I just have fragments after that, Goober said. My parents kept me away from the worst of it. In a couple of days, we were in a big town shelter before the cold came. I remember my mother brushing the dirt off my sister's face before we went into that shelter. Got to look your best, you see. Oh, I remember how lousy it got in that shelter. Everybody got cold and hungry and scared, and then angry, bitter and jealous. And I remember how my mother was upset that the Ihai, the tablets of her dead ancestors, were lost. 1,000 years of continuity for her just swept away like that. I think she felt as helpless as an orphan herself. She died soon after. After my sister helped run the underground township that grew out of that shelter and a couple of others. And I, I ended up here. He smiled, uncomfortable.
Michael Poole clapped him on the shoulder. With the meeting over, Weinbaum Grant, the virtual projection from Gear, approached Jophiel. Michael, asked me to remind you, are you ready to come over to the Gear? He sighed. Call me Jophiel. Sure. It's why I exist. You're leaving? Nicola hurried over and drew Jophiel aside. Wait, she said softly. I have something for you. She dug in a pocket. Hold your hand out. Bemused, Jophiel obeyed. She held up a kind of pendant, a small grass-green tetrahedron on the end of a broken line. She dropped it. In the one gravity-thrust regime of the couchy, it fell. Without thinking, Jophiel grasped at it. He expected his virtual fingers to close on nothing, a sting of consistency protocol violation. But he found the tetrahedron settling into his palm, cool, heavy. She grinned. You're not the only one who can pull virtual stunts. The amulet. The real thing. Michael has it safe here on the couchy. He looked again at the amulet. Reality leaks, he said. What's that? Just something I overheard. Look, I'm following orders, for once. Ward and Poole told me to give you a panic button. If you need to break out of there, why would I need that? She glanced over at Weinbaum, who was talking to a crew member. How in Leith would I know? That's the point, isn't it? Something odd is going on over there on the Gear. So be prepared. For me, okay? Jophiel hesitated. He, or his template, was as close to Nicola Emery as he had been to anybody, save maybe Miriam Berg, who had stayed in the solar system and was now separated from him by light years and centuries, if she still lived at all. He had always had a combative relationship with Nicola. Yet, here she was, following him, or his template anyhow, to the stars. And here she was now, looking out for him. You're staring, Poole. He grinned, rueful. You always did make me think. That's my job. The moment passed. He tucked the amulet into a pocket of his own, and they walked back to Weinbaum. Nicola said loudly, I never understood why there can't be a physical inspection of the Gear anyhow. Weinbaum smiled. Well, there is a logic. A processing suite of that capacity, not to mention some pretty delicate observation instruments, needs stillness, stability, calm. So, no flesh and blood people, no big heavy sacks of water moving around, breathing in, breathing out. You should hear my sister and the other officers complain. So, Jophiel asked, how do we do this? It's easy, Weinbaum said, and reached out to him. Jophiel took his hand, virtual palm to virtual palm. The flesh felt real and warm. The couchy dissolved around them. Chapter 4. The central purpose of Gear was the collection and processing of data. From his earliest sketches of his quixotic millennia-long mission to the galactic core, Michael Poole had always been aware of his own and humanity's profound ignorance about the Chile, both the assumed individual and its species. He'd had no clear idea of how he would confront the Chile when he finally tracked it to its presumed lair at the centre of the galaxy. Even that final destination was a matter of guesswork. The Chile had been observed apparently heading that way after it had left for the stars, leaving behind machines and client species, its cages and its dust plague, to continue the work of grinding the worlds of the solar system to drifting dust. But then, it had vanished.
evidently with the use of a faster-than-light hyperdrive of unknown principles. Such experts as there were on the Chile, scientists like Highsmith Marston on Galileo,